Welcome to The Buzz. I'm Christopher Conover. This week, Southern Arizona's housing market. In September, we took a look at the residential real estate and home building markets. When you look at that market, you leave out about a third of Southern Arizonans. Those are the people who rent their homes. A recent study by Moody's Analytics found that the median rent in Arizona's largest housing markets has almost doubled since 2005, bringing decreased affordability in many areas. And while wages have grown, they haven't kept pace. The percent of income that rent takes up on average in Tucson has gone up by about 7% in that same time. To start today's episode, we hear from that report's author, Lu Chen, a senior economist at Moody's. Our conversation starts with why the rent-to-income ratio is growing.
So this has to go back to the fundamentals of demographics. It has one of the best universities. Many graduates ended up staying within the metropolitan area, and that is really beneficial for the workforce. And also, they help support the key industries such as defense. I have just gotten the latest employment data, and Tucson actually topped the list in terms of the quarter-over-quarter employment growth in the third quarter. This is the fastest growing metropolitan areas in terms of the job growth. And other thing which also goes into the demographic consideration is the general population growth. Tucson, if you look at the US map, it's so close to some of the adjacent rent burden metropolitan areas, especially places in the neighboring California, SoCal, Southern California area. And it has drawn a lot of retirees inflow into the Tucson area and also some of the wealthy families. So I was comparing what has happened in 2019 and 2022, and there was a particular category in that income distribution of Tucson which has drawn my attention, which was the family or renter household who's earning $75,000 and above. So back in 2019, only about 13% of the total renter household earned that much of income. But now, fast forward to 2022, that's when the latest census data stops at really about a year ago. That number has jumped from 13% over to 20%. Although it's not representative of the total population, total renter household for Tucson, but it's a significant representation of how much wealthier renter household we were able to draw into this metro area.
Want to look at another Southern Arizona community, Yuma. Since 2005, their rents have gone up about 50%. However, their rent-to-income ratio went down by a percentage point, while Tucson's went up by 6 percentage points. What's the difference?
Great question. So just as what we described, the gentrification for Tucson, we're actually seeing the reverse for Yuma. We are seeing a subtle decline of that wealthier income population as compared to the neighboring other Arizona metropolitan area. I think it's going back to the fundamental of Yuma's economy. So it's a growing economy. It's still upbeat the national average, but there is a significant presence of single industry, the farming and defense industry, which are dominating a lot of the workforce. And sure, it's a very nice, very affordable, great lifestyle community, which continue to draw in migration, but a lot of that in-migration heavily concentrated in the population ages 65 and above. And there is actually a subtle decline of the ratio of the population who's earning higher income from 2019.
So what is it that causes rent to outpace income growth?
So at the national level, A driving systematic factor is really this COVID pandemic migration and reverse migration flow. In early 2020, 2021, a lot of people were drawn to the lifestyle, this remote dynamic work arrangement. So they in-migrate to the places like Tucson, like Yuma, or even further to the south, to Texas, or to the South Atlantic region into Florida. And when the population start flowing at above average pace, they propelled the local rent level. So there has been a lot of demographic shift, which has churned up the rent level from the demand side. On the supply side, if we recall early in the pandemic, there has been a lot of limitation on the supply chain. So the construction was delayed, permitting was taking longer. So all these factors has dragged down the inventory growth in many places. Both factors combined really gave a lot of push to the rent level. Part of that is sustainable because Tucson and other places within Arizona remain favorable destination of migration, and especially the younger population, the younger professionals, and the educated group being able to retain or drawn into Arizona will continue to provide the sustainability or resiliency of that market demand. On the other hand, if we look at the income growth, so there has been period of time where the income was not able to catch up with the rent growth. So now we have entered into a new era where the rent growth is stabilizing. In many cases, we might see volatility on a subtle rent decline based on the seasonality. But the income growth, the wage growth, continue to be at 3 to 4 percentage points on an annual basis. So that has been outpacing the rent growth, which to a certain extent, to places where they are suffering from the rent burden, they are suffering from the exceptional rent growth and causing a rent burden to majority of their household. It wasn't a problem for Arizona. Putting Flagstaff at a different story, but it wasn't a problem to begin with for Phoenix and Tucson, but still that offered the needed relief.
You mentioned a minute ago Phoenix and Tucson metro areas and said, leave Flagstaff out. It's a different world up in Flagstaff. And you did a study regarding Flagstaff, and one of the things that really caught me in that is it was the 7th least affordable market for families in the 25th percentile. So what happens when much of a community's housing stock is out of reach for the community?
It's devastating. I totally agree with your sentiment on that. What happened when we are only looking at the top 70, 80 metropolitan areas in the United States and examining their rent burden? Flagstaff was never part of the picture because it wasn't fading into that bigger metro definition. But when we relax to cover nearly 200, 300 metros altogether, Flagstaff all of a sudden pop on the list. So it's really an eye-popping moment when we start seeing Flagstaff was the local residents was taking less than 30% rent burden to begin with prior to pandemic. And now all of a sudden, we are seeing it's the number 7 on the list as the top rent burdens metros. So we all know it has really benefited from the leisure and hospitality industry. And there has been a lot of growing in the metro's housing market and desire of entering the housing market in Flagstaff. But the problem with Flagstaff is really the wealthier population, the people who's providing the gentrification to the local market isn't a sustainable force of the burden of that rental market. So we see the market rent has been propelled by the wealthier families moving in and the people who's demanding the local residency. But that pushed the local residents who's on the lower spectrum of the income distribution out. And we've seen that in the Southern Florida area. We've seen that in Miami. We've seen that in places in Nevada where the tourism was also the leading industry, right? So Las Vegas, Reno had similar problem. And Flagstaff is really something we want to continue watching and paying attention, because the fast-growing senior citizen cohort is one of the dominant population group we are seeing, which could potentially getting some of the squeeze from the higher rent burden.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
That was Liu Chen, senior economist at Moody's Analytics. As rents increase in the region's largest metro area, the Tucson Tenants Union has taken up the task of helping renters band together in hopes of keeping people housed. Zyra Livier is the union's director and founder. I started by asking her how it got started.
Yeah, the Tucson Tenants Union was a project born out of the organization People's Defense Initiative. And what it is, it's a union of tenants, Tucson tenants specifically. So that is, we define a tenant as anyone who doesn't have control of their housing. So that includes renters, homeless, community members, low-income folks who have mortgages. It's a union of folks who believe that housing is a human right and who are connecting with their neighbors and pushing against displacement and against, you know, all the ways in which poor working class people are oppressed in kind of the market of housing that we have now. And that when we started at the start of 2000, so we're going on our fourth year at the start of this coming year.
When it comes to helping people, especially low income, which I'm guessing is where you concentrate more, but how do you make sure they're getting fair treatment and help them out when they aren't getting fair treatment, and making sure that they still have stable housing that they can afford and not get themselves in further financial trouble?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really heavy task. So it's one of those things that is extremely complicated. Where the Tucson Tenants Union comes in is that we're not a services-based organization. So what we're doing is building a union, just like a job. We're building unity. We're organizing tenants to work together. There isn't much that you can do. There's almost nothing that you can do when you're a low-income tenant. So what we're doing is, one, getting to know each other. Two, moving with them to educate them politically. Make sure that folks know their rights, to then also make sure that folks know where the resources are. And when all of those things fail, because a right is not a right unless you can enforce it, having the community support to be able to help each other through. But in the end, what we're trying to build is a large, cohesive unity of tenants who are empowered, who are emboldened to care for each other, to fight back, and to be politically literate enough to then push for the changes that they want to see with a unified front, pushing against rent hikes, pushing against the displacement of low-income families, pushing also against the criminalization of our homeless community members, making sure that people have a place to sleep at the end of the day. And now we're having leaders in their own respective apartment complexes building their own locals. We have had good results. We created the Emergency Eviction Legal Services Office in Pima County. And that office now, if you are a low-income tenant in Pima County, you have the right to an attorney if you're being evicted.
When it comes to eviction-related laws in the state or in the county in the Tucson metro area, how do we stand up compared to other areas? Are our laws better, worse? I guess it depends on which side of the law you're standing on with that. But from the tenants union standpoint, how do we compare to others?
Well, we're in Arizona, so most of our housing laws is at the state level. So our housing and eviction laws are completely stacked against the tenant. So it's incredibly difficult. And you can just see by the numbers. Before the pandemic in Pima County, we were having thousands of evictions every single month. 90 to 95% of folks didn't even show up. 95% of those cases are ruled in favor of the landlord or the company. So pretty drastic and devastating numbers. We were already in crisis before the pandemic. And since the pandemic hit, nothing's changed other than we have the EELS office now. And that's when we were able to really push it and get it done, is when it was actually incredibly clear that eviction meant death for people in the middle of the height of the pandemic, still does. Unfortunately, the laws in Arizona are, like with almost everything else, are pretty oppressive, and they really don't give a tenant much choice. And it's also, you won't believe this, but a lot of attorneys don't do that kind of law, right? Like, we don't have, as a union, we have a lot of connections everywhere, but a very limited amount of attorneys out there who are well-versed in this area of law, which is why it's so important for tenants to come together. It's very easy to bully and move around one or two people or three or four to raise the rent in your trailer park. It's going to be much difficult when you have all of your tenants, 50% of your tenants say, hey, if you do this, we're going to withhold the rent.
One of the things you mentioned, and you're not the first person to mention this that I've heard in the last year or two especially, is Wall Street companies, big national companies coming in, buying up local properties. For people who don't understand why that's a problem, is the big issue, if I've rented somewhere for a while and it's locally owned, I can go to the office and say, hey, I just lost my job. Can we work something out? I've been here a while. Is it that loss of relationship?
That could be one problem. What we've seen mostly is that these apartment complexes or whatever, they get sold and the new company wants to do some renovations or just wants to do a blanket raising of the rent. And they're not going stepwise. So they're not going like $25, or they're not grandfathering people in. They're just lifting those. There's been a lot of moments where we've seen new owners and everyone's getting kicked out so that they can do some renovations and double the rent. That's one. Here's the worst one. Them buying a place, letting all of the folks finish up their leases, and then they hold on to them. And they hold on to them for a long time. They may never even rent it out. Why? Because it's a numbers game. If they sit on that property long enough, they're going to get their money back. And the way that we see with these national investment companies is that they're not there to provide housing. They're there to make a profit. So what we're seeing is valuable places, places that could be homes to the folks that need homes in Tucson, being removed from the market. And worse off, turned into rentals, Airbnbs again, taken away from those of us in Tucson who need affordable housing, and putting and taking it out of the market and never being allowed to be used for housing, which is so tragic to see so many people, especially now in Tucson, out on the streets when there's so much housing out there. We have hundreds of, if not thousands of empty units, and yet people are outside in the heat or in the dead of winter dying.
Well, thanks for spending some time with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That was Zyra Livier of the Tucson Tenants Union. You may have caught mention of the Pima County Emergency Eviction Legal Services Office in that interview. The office started in 2021 and helps those facing eviction navigate the legal system. To learn more about that work, I spoke with Andy Flagg, whose department oversees the office.
The main reason is because it's a court process. It's an adversarial process. That's the way it's designed to be. Most landlords have representation and historically have had representation in eviction courts across the country and including here in Pima County. And so historically, tenants don't have that representation. And so it's not been historically a level playing field for tenants who go into eviction court. The Landlord-Tenant Act is complicated, as is the process that takes place in court. People who step into court and who aren't familiar with it, who haven't been through the court process or trained in the court process, it can be confusing. Legal advice, legal representation, number one, it empowers tenants by allowing them to know what their rights are and what their rights are not under the law. And then for those cases that are appropriate for full-blown representation in court, it provides that level playing field for tenants. And what we've seen through our program is for those tenants who get full representation, about 50% of them have a positive outcome, which is, you know, compared to unrepresented tenants, landlords win essentially 100% of the time.
You can't watch Law and Order a couple episodes and have it down. You really need somebody who knows what they're doing.
Absolutely. It's a complicated process. And the lawyers that we have are all experts on the eviction process and understand how to appear, act, and advocate in court.
The office also has navigators who can help anyone regardless of income level with information, connecting with assistant programs. What are the most common things that people don't know?
A lot of times, it's really just better information about the process. We have tenants who contact us frequently who say, I'm being evicted next Tuesday. And what we learn is that that's really when their court hearing is. That's not when the constable is going to show up and change the locks. And knowing that they have another week to transition out of their place is hugely beneficial to them. We also get a lot of requests with respect to what resources are there to keep people in their current place, whether that be rental assistance or something like that, and also what resources are available for somebody who is going to be put out of their unit. And those requests come not just from the tenants, they come from landlords too, because landlords don't want to put people out on the street either. And so those are some of the common things that our navigators are very familiar with. Community resources are limited, but they're able to connect folks who qualify with those resources. Another real benefit, I think, to the Navigator program and to the fact that it's within the county's Community and Workforce Development Department is direct connections to job assistance, because one of the things that folks who are on the brink of eviction need is a path to not just staying housed, but to a sustainable financial situation. And so we can directly integrate folks, get them into our workforce development programs that we operate out of our department.
People may be surprised that there are so many services available, especially helping people who've been evicted or are about to be evicted find other places to live so they're not just out on the street.
Sure. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've learned through coming in and developing this program is just the value of having that person in court, either virtually or in person, who you can connect directly with and who can help walk you through the steps to get toward, is there a housing program we can get you into, or even just working with them toward moving to a temporary living situation, whether it be with family or friends, just helping walk folks through that process, having a human being who understands not only the legal process, but also the programming that's available has been a real benefit, like I said, both to tenants and landlords.
So the first year the office was in, you helped 1,200 people with some level of legal assistance, 200 people with full legal assistance. That report that has those numbers is a year old. How busy is this office now?
It's just gotten busier, Chris. We've had now through the fiscal year, which ended in June, we're up to almost 5,000 households served total across the services we have available, and almost 500 have received full representation in court. So we're continuing to see a high demand for service. We've been able to meet that with the resources we have. Some of those resources are coming to an end, including the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, which obviously causes us some concern, but we'll continue to help the households who reach out to us with whatever services we have available.
Those services you mentioned, the money, it's a money question. Where does the money come from? And it sounds like there's never enough.
Yeah, I think with the pandemic relief funding, I think we got as close to there being enough as anybody who I work with has ever seen. But obviously, the community need is large. So just as the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, as an example, the county's distributed about $88 million over the course of the various pandemic relief programs. That funding is very close to being exhausted. To the question of where does the money come from, there are a variety of funding sources that fund our programs within our department. And that's why I think it's been so important to have this eviction legal services program be part of a broader social service network through our Community and Workforce Development Department, because we have annual grants that fund workforce development programs, which can also pay supportive services for enrolled clients. We have grants that come through the Housing and Urban Development Department with respect to housing programming, and other funding sources that we can leverage because they're part of our department's portfolio, and really try to serve people in as holistic a way as we possibly can.
So when should someone get in touch with the office? Is it the minute they miss a rental payment and they know that's not going to be a one-time issue? Or do they need to wait until a landlord has begun eviction proceedings? When should they reach out?
They really should reach out to us as soon as they know that an eviction is likely. Usually that happens when they receive a written notice from the landlord. Before the case goes to court, the law requires that the landlord provide a written notice saying either, if it's a non-payment of rent case, you've got 5 days to fix this, or if it's another type of breach of the lease, usually it's a 10-day notice. As soon as they get that notice, we'd like them to reach out to us. Your legal options get less and less the further into the process you get. So as soon as folks know that an eviction looks likely on the horizon, they should contact our office and we can get them a consultation with an attorney if they're eligible within 2 to 3 days.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in and giving us some information.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
That was Andy Flagg of Pima County's Emergency Eviction Legal Services Office. And that's The Buzz for this week. Tune in next week as we review the results of Tuesday's local elections. You can find all our episodes online at azpm.org and subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for The Buzz Arizona. We're also on the NPR app. Zach Ziegler is our producer with production help from Desiree Tucker. Our music is by Enter the Haggis. I'm Christopher Conover. Thanks for listening.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.